Well, howdy and welcome to the Real Love Podcast. I'm your host, Connor Rock. This is the podcast where every week me and a guest will sit down to talk about the movies we love, why we love them, and through the magic of film, the power to provoke, intrigue, inspire, and promote change in the world around us. Let's get to it.
I have my dear friend from Colorado. I have Justin Lozado here with me. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Okay, well, we're here to talk about the film Fruitvale Station. It's the directorial debut from, I'm having a complete brain fart, from our first-time director, Ryan Coogler, who has also directed the films Creed and Black Panther. So this is a difficult thing to just kind of to dive into. Justin, is there anything you want to say before we get started on the review, or?
I'll say this, and it's not so much a disclaimer or a warning, but just, you know, right now, maybe you can see across our nation that it's a really difficult time, and that's an understatement. So we are going to be definitely talking about, specifically about the civil unrest happening in terms of the protests. We're also going to, you know, talk about Fruitvale Station, which is, unfortunately, it's still a timely and still a relevant film. Definitely, I recommend checking it out. If you want to catch it at no cost to you, there's a streaming service called Tubi, T-U-B-I. Just download it, and it's available for you to watch at no cost. But this is going to be an honest dialogue where, and I've known Connor for quite a while now, we're not going to be, you know, pointed and accusing. It's just an open dialogue that, you know, happens to, you know, also stem from a conversation on a film. And also we'll be diving into even my experiences as a former law enforcement officer as well. So sit back. Have your ears open and just get ready to listen to a great dialogue between two friends.
Wonderful. All right, so let's get started. So the film starts, the film is basically a day in the life of Oscar Grant III, with a flashback thrown in. And we'll get to that when that comes up in the film. So the film starts, it starts with him waking up. And I'm trying to think how it begins.
So yes, it pretty much it starts with him waking up. You know, you have the date on the screen letting you know when we are, and also, you know, where we are. So it takes place in, it's based on a true story, by the way. So if you know the details of the story.
Yeah, disclosure, then, we're going to spoil the movie. So, but it, you know, spoilers for real life. So hopefully you know what's happened.
It's based on a true story, and we'll dive more into that later on. But let you know when it took place. He's waking up, him and his girlfriend. They have a daughter. That's pretty much where it starts there. And it's pretty much, it is the last documented, not actual documentary, but from accounts, life in the day of Oscar Grant before he died.
So we get it going from there. We start his day. Oscar and his girlfriend, are both, kind of heading off for their day. He, I guess it starts with him, or is he driving her to work? Is that how the movie starts? I can't quite remember now.
Yeah, exactly. So his daughter, she comes, she knocks on the door, some small talk in the kitchen, and he drives his, you know, drops his daughter off at daycare, and he drops his daughter, his girlfriend off at work.
I also want to talk about, this was, I would say the first real big, like feature film that, Michael B. Jordan had been in at that time. This was kind of what put him on the map. He was in a show called Parenthood, that I know he kind of got some attention from, but this was the first like directorial or the first feature film, that really he got that attention.
Yeah. That I noticed him in another TV show he was also in was The Wire on HBO. So, yeah, he was on there for a couple of seasons. I don't want to spoil the the fate of his character in that show. But definitely, if you get a chance and you've never seen The Wire, I highly recommend that show as well. But I think that was like one of the earliest things I had recognized him in.
Yeah. Yeah. I still need to watch The Wire. I feel guilty about that one. But anyway, so it continues. Oscar goes and drops his girlfriend off at work. Looks like they both work at a grocery store. Is that correct?
Looks like it. She works at one store and then
and he works at another.
He worked
at another one. So he drops her off. And then the day continues. He's telling her that he's going to drop by work, and pick up something. So we follow him. He stops at a gas station. The reason why I'm bringing this up is, there's a moment where he encounters, I guess it would be almost like a pit bull mix,
yeah,
a sweet dog. Yeah. Stray dog. And he, bonds with the dog, and then the dog proceeds to get hit by a car, within 30 seconds of him bonding with that dog. In this scene, I feel like we're kind of, they're definitely using, the language of film to establish empathy with Oscar, which it works. And then from there, we go to Oscar going to his job. We find out, shortly after him being there that he's no longer employed. He's been fired, because he was late. And I also appreciate about this scene at the grocery store is they also make sure to spotlight that Oscar wasn't a perfect man. He struggled with infidelity. They show him with another woman, and he's making advances on her and being a little maybe too flirty. But that's up to you and your own say. But they're definitely showing him, trying their best to show him as a real human being.
Yeah, I like that. The film is just full of nuances. And when you really think about it, and I wonder how long the actual screenplay was, but the film's only 85 minutes. But like I said, if you know the story of what happened already, once the film opens up, there's already this sense of foreboding throughout the film, because like I said, you already know what's going to happen and you're just watching this man, a dramatized events of his final day on earth. And then also just taking into account, when the film took place. I think New Year's Eve, 2008, going into 2009. And in the background at the gas station scene, you still see stickers of President Obama, President.
Oh, I'm glad you noticed that.
In the background, so Obama had just been elected president, and there's this sense of change in the air for a lot of people. And I've never been to California, and so there's a lot of exterior shots and shots of just the Bay Area itself, because I believe it was filmed on location. So it's really just everything. It's just painting the picture, the location, and his interactions with people, just painting the picture of this person.
When I think about this movie, I think about, there's a famous Roger Ebert quote, the film critic, if anyone doesn't know who I'm talking about. I hope you do. Roger Ebert famously said, he said, cinema is an empathy machine, which is very, so very true. Apropos and very, very appropriate for this film in particular. I feel like what Ryan Coogler is trying to say with this film, I feel like he's trying to say, this could be your brother, this could be your friend, this could be anyone.
Exactly.
And trying to create that connection.
It is. The film is focused on one person, but the thing about stories are that they are universal. And even before, watching the film again, because it had been a while since I had seen it, just to refresh myself on, some of the background information, to the story, it's a story about contrast as well, because you see where Oscar, come from and how, the bit of how he grew up. All of that is a very important, factor that really goes into the story. And the film doesn't really have to say a lot in terms of dialogue, but it says so much itself.
Very much. It's a very succinct statement. You had mentioned earlier that it's a pretty short film, which I actually appreciated watching it the second time around. I appreciated that it doesn't take a long time to get to where it's going. And I feel like it packs more of a wallop because of that, because it's not drawn out. Okay, so from the grocery store, Oscar then goes to pick up some food. His family's going to be having it's New Year's Eve, so they're going to be having like a party, a family get together. And he's bringing, I guess it was it some lobster, I
Yeah, it was
think is what
crab.
he's bringing.
So crab legs. So it was
Crab legs.
his
Okay.
mom's birthday,
Yep.
and that's why his girlfriend got the cake from where she worked, and he went to his now former job to get some crab legs, and then from there they go see they pick up his daughter, they see her family for a little bit, and then they go to see his his mom and everybody for the birthday celebration before they head out to San Francisco to go see the fireworks and the go New Year's Eve celebrations.
And we also, there's also a scene where, because he's in such a predicament since he's lost a job at the grocery store, there's some. This is kind of where we see a flashback. Oscar had previously been put in jail, and it seems to be because of drug charges. Looks like he's been selling marijuana or weed, and obviously this is before, it was legal in California. So, But Oscar goes to a park, and goes to meet a friend of his, and is set, it looks like, on going to sell the weed that he has. He meets up with the friend. The friend asks him if he wants to smoke with him. He says no, and he kind of at that point reconsiders selling the weed. It feels like he's had a bit of a change of the soul, and he's trying to do good. And it feels like life is definitely giving him, it's challenging him, even though he's trying really, really hard to go on the straight and narrow. As life does, it's a little too difficult to do that. And it, kind of whether it does it in a great way or not, it comments a little bit on the trap of the prison system and how easy it is to get stuck in that cycle. Just briefly, I wouldn't say it does like a masterful job of it, but it does comment on it briefly.
That's funny, yeah, because I mean, the first, I think, dialogue in the film was, I think he said, he's going to stop selling trees or he's going to stop selling marijuana. So, yeah, you get to that point where, yeah, he goes, he calls his friend up because, I think he was talking to his sister. And she says she needed some money for rent. And,
Yep.
yep, so he goes, to the, he calls his friend. He said he'll meet him in about an hour. He goes to this, park. And there, you see one of the flashback sequences to when he was in prison, and so he decides to, dump the marijuana that he had into, I guess, the bay. And then, his friend comes, he tells him he doesn't have it. I guess he just had like this little dime or nickel bag or something. And yeah, his friend asks him if he wants to smoke with him and all that, and he says no. And you can see, yeah, it's exactly like you said. He's trying to turn his life around, and he knows that it would be easy money for him to go down that path. But, a person who gets out of jail in a lot of ways, they are still imprisoned because they are physically no longer in jail. But if you're on parole, you have the felony record, which prevents you from getting a lot of jobs. So, yeah, very much it is very systemic of how people get caught up into this cycle.
Yep, exactly. So from there we go to Oscar goes home. He changes. They pick up his daughter, and they go home. And then I'm trying to think of where from there. I'm skipping over a little bit, but they go and they have this family get together, and I loved that scene. I love there's such heart and warmth, and Octavia Spencer is great as always, and it really does a good job of before we kind of jump into what happened to this man. It does another masterful job of bridging that empathy, and it definitely feels like this could be anyone's family.
So at that point, yeah, the film was like pretty much a little halfway over at that point. It's a very short film. And from there, you know, they go to drop his daughter off with his girlfriend's sister, you know, before they head out to New Year's Eve. And I mean, and just putting it all in context, the last scene before they go to the celebrations is the fact that that was the last time that man had saw his daughter.
Yeah. Yep. And that definitely weighs on that scene. You can feel that weight.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? And so from there, one thing I also wanted to talk about is I love there's the scene where they're having the gumbo, and the movie definitely has that, the way that food can kind of bring, unite a family and the warmth and love that's through food. You know, they always say that, you know, I think food is the quickest way to show love and affection in a family. And you definitely feel that there. So from there, Oscar's mom agrees that up to this point, they've been looking for someone to watch their daughter. And Oscar's mom agrees to watch their daughter. And they're talking about driving up to go see the fireworks in Fremont, right? Is that where they were going?
So they went down to San Francisco because they always just said, you know, Frisco.
Frisco, yeah. That's right.
But that was a scene, right, talking about where, you know, instead of driving, that he should take the train.
Yeah, his mom says it's like a kindness, like, oh, no, then you guys can get some drinks and you don't have to worry. You should take the BART. So they end up doing that. They get on the train. They meet up with some friends. Yeah, we go from there. So at this point, I don't mean to speed through this. I feel like I'm speeding through the film, but it is a quick movie. At this point, they board the train. They're heading to San Francisco. They're not going to make it quite by midnight. So one of their friends, and this definitely felt like a time capsule of that time. It's funny how even 2009 can feel so old already. They take a phone and they jack in the speakers. Most of the characters in this film have flip phones. Definitely made me recount my time with my flip phone. And they jam out just having their own little party on the train. And I love that scene.
I do too, because I mean, like you said, it is definitely a time capsule. We think, ooh, 2009, that's so long ago, and it's like it's 11 years ago. I was still living in South Dakota at that time. I was stationed there with the Air Force, and yeah, I mean, but that's the thing, the authenticity of it. You can tell that they were definitely trying to recreate a moment in a snapshot in time. And believe it or not, for some people, they'd be like, oh, who cares if there's a iPhone in the background or something like that. I mean, iPhones were out back in 2009, but just the authenticity of it all and the attention to detail to recreate this moment in this person's life. And it's just, to me, those small moments that really just, you know, brings that moment back to life, you know, and immerses the viewer.
Very much, very much. And I also want to just talk about again about how good Michael B. Jordan is in this movie. And it's maybe a simple thing, but he's just so, so likable and so charismatic that it's definitely on purpose that you know, he's the perfect lead character and the perfect character to bridge that empathy. Just because he can be doing like brushing his teeth or the smallest task. And he's just so, so likable. And, you know, he's also super handsome he's such a movie star, and it's apparent in this movie already.
Yeah. And at this point, I mean, he's been in quite a few films, and of course, you know, obviously films such as Creed and, you know, Black Panther really solidified his, you know, star status. But a lot of these smaller films, they are great springboards, that just really highlight, you know, their, I mean, just really their acting prowess before they go on and do these big budget films.
Very much, very much. And this movie, I think, premiered at Sundance, actually, didn't it?
It is. It is a Sundance.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, so let's just wrap this up and then we can get to more thoughts, because I feel a little tied in with the recounting the movie. So from there, so they play the music. It's now past midnight. They head back once they see some of the last bits of the fireworks. They head back on the train. Actually, no, excuse me. I skipped over a part. So they're in the city, and there's a scene where all the girls that they're hanging out with, his girlfriend and her girlfriends, they all need to use the restroom. And there's a scene where he basically through kind of just how good of a human being Oscar is and how kind and charming he is, he's able to get the store owner to let the person into the restroom, let his girlfriend and let her girlfriends into the restroom. And at that time, another white gentleman approaches with his wife, who appears to be pregnant. And Oscar goes out of his way to make sure that he lets that gentleman's wife in to use the restroom as well. And I couldn't help but think about in that moment, and it definitely subverts that expectation. I because there's been so many incidents with white men and black men where, like, I thought about the account of it was the video where there was a black man that was trying to get into his upscale apartment. I think it was actually in San Francisco, and a white man wouldn't let him in. He was going to see maybe a friend. I can't quite remember.
And
the white man calls the cops on him.
Oh,
they're basically all the same at this point, and that's another problem that we can talk about. But I thought about that in the scene, and I felt like, oh, it's funny for a movie to almost feel naive about how things have gotten at this point. It feels very optimistic for the world that we're living in currently. And that was sad to feel that way. But
yeah, that scene actually, there's a couple of scenes that just, you know, as soon as they come on and they play out, the tears start to well up just a little bit. And that's definitely one of them, because I mean, he's talking with this guy about, you know, marriage. And, you know, they talk about how, you know, well, you know, what's stopping you from getting married? And Oscar says, I have no money. And the guy says, you shouldn't even let that stop you from getting married, because he tells him how he pretty much started from nothing, and even tells him that the wedding ring, you know, when Oscar asked him, how'd you get a ring? He said he stole it. He said, I had no money either. But, you know, he started his own web design company, and I guess it was really successful to where he can buy his wife the ring that she wanted or he felt she deserved. And, you know, before they, you know, part ways, you know, he gives Oscar his business card. And you can, that's, you know, just highlighting again that this guy who has, in fact, you know, just doing some research earlier on, you know, Oscar Grant's life, he didn't even graduate high school. He stopped at the 10th grade. He got a GED. But he went to jail, prison, San Quentin. And like I said, when you get out of prison, it's sort of like you're still imprisoned in so many ways, because it's sort of like you're not a full citizen. And so then, I mean, you can see that he's really trying to stay on the straight and narrow. But, you know, because of things that he did earlier in his life, you know, where, you know, the system and people can be unforgiving and don't think certain people don't deserve a second chance, then people just get caught up again. They get frustrated. But yeah, that scene, that really just added a lot of, just a lot of substance there, and just add to the overall larger story.
Very much, very much. And it's interesting. I also, when I think about that scene and I think about how he's talking about, oh yeah, I stole it. I think about, what, and forgive me as a white man talking about this, but what privilege he has to be able to steal. And Oscar also, who was trying to make ends meet to survive, was put in jail and stuck in the prison complex system. And this white man had the opportunity to steal and then go on to create this seemingly a successful business. As much as, you know, Oscar may want to do that and have that drive, you know, there's still the reality that it's going to be, you know, 10 times harder for him to do that as opposed to this white man that's, you know.
I said it's a film full of contrasts.
Yeah, for sure. for sure. All right. So from there, the whole group goes back to the train. They're heading home, and they're nothing really happens at that point. The announcer comes on and says, "Next stop, Fruitvale Station." And at that point, I guess someone that knows Oscar, I can't quite, I think so, right? Is this like a,
so yeah, that
he's maybe sold to? I'm not certain.
So this, yeah, it ties back to the flashback in the prison scene where he got into a verbal altercation with this guy when his mom came to visit, says, "If I ever see you on the streets." And so when he, he's moving more towards the, I guess, the middle or the back of the car that they're riding in. And the girl, Katie, that he had met earlier in the grocery store, yells his name out and says, "Hi, Oscar," the one he helped out with, you know, for the fish fry she was having. And then that, I guess that guy had heard his name being called, and it turned out to be the same guy from when he was in prison a couple of years earlier. And they get into an altercation, and then you can hear over the PA system that, you know, there's a disturbance on the train, and the police is coming, you know, stay calm, the police is coming. And, you know, just even because I watch films with the captions on, mm-hmm. and, you know, you sort of think to yourself, I was like, stay calm, the police is coming. There's a lot of people who don't feel calm when the police show up.
Yep. Very, very much. And it's even gotten worse since then. So at that point, the police do show up. They basically all of his friends, they all get off of the train. They're saying, "Oh, let's run, let's get away before the police get here." The police come and they catch them. Oscar goes back onto the train to try and get away so he isn't caught. They tell him to, he's away on the train, and the police officer, one of the police officers, you were saying, what was the actor that was playing him?
So, Kevin Durant.
Kevin Durant.
A lot of, you know, character
Officer,
actor.
Yeah. Officer Caruso is yep. the name of him. So, yeah, at that point, Officer Caruso goes and pulls Oscar off the train. And his friends are already huddled in against the wall up on the train station. He asks, or he pleads Oscar to get on the ground, forcing him on the ground. Do you want to talk from here, Justin? Because I don't feel comfortable discussing this part.
So pretty much, you know, you see a lot of films that said based on a true story, and then you go research the actual accounts, and it's like, that didn't even happen. So, I mean, as far as dramatic liberties taken with the film, I think there were very little taken, but the events that have played out, obviously, based on the eyewitness accounts, there were copious amounts of cell phone footage taken then and shared. So what pretty much happens leading up to him being shot was they get to their stop, they get off the train, and they split up. Oscar's girlfriend, you know, she's able to actually get down off of the platform, and his friends, you know, tell him to get back on the train, and they end up getting thrown up against the wall and everything. And the officer, in fact, in the movie, the guy's name is Caruso. The real cop was, I think his name is Perone, Officer Perone. And then I guess because they were sort of dressed in a similar fashion, you know, T-shirt, sweatpants, whatnot, you know, the cop tells him to get off. And, you know, at the point, there's a lot of verbal back and forth between the responding officers. And then it's not Officer Caruso who actually ends up shooting him. It's actually another officer played by Chad Michael Murray, who I didn't even really recognize him at first.
I didn't either. I'm looking at the IMDb now, and it was like, wait, he was in the movie?
Yeah, that was him. At first, I thought, is that the guy from the Book of Mormon musical? I thought it was Andrew Rannells at first.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I did, because they sort of looked a little similar, I guess, and you know, right there. And it was Chad Michael Murray. And so in the movie, he's credited as Officer Ingram, the real cop who shot him. His name is Johannes, I think Marcel or something. It's actually a guy born in Germany.
Oh, wow.
He, you know, in his defense during his trial, he was The movie says charged with first degree murder. I think it was second degree murder, but he ended up being found guilty on involuntary manslaughter. And so in his defense, he said that when he went to pull his weapon, he thought he had grabbed his taser instead of his actual service weapon.
And this is kind of where I want to draw upon your experience, you know, at serving in the police forces. What do you buy that? What is your opinion about it?
You know, some people are probably going to say, you know, BS. Is it plausible? Sure. But I also think about the fact that, I mean, I know when I wore my utility belt with my service weapon and taser on it, they were definitely on separate sides. When you pull a weapon that's that has a fully loaded magazine, it's going to have a different weight to it than a light taser. It's going to feel different, definitely. Your taser is yellow, sort of easy to be able to distinguish the two.
Yeah.
I mean, when your adrenaline is going and it's tense and you're not paying attention,
mm-hmm.
is it possible? Yeah, sure, it's possible. I can't read somebody's mind and don't know exactly what was going through their mind in that instant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to try to pretend to. But it's really tough to talk about. Even for me, it is tough to talk about.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. I was thinking, I was listening to a really great podcast. I want to put quite a few links in the show notes of this podcast, because there's been some really good things that I've found. One of them, where they were recounting, it was Pod Saved America. And they're a fantastic podcast. All the hosts are people of color. And they were talking about, I can't quite remember which account this was, which incident this was, but basically when they go to tase, they usually announce it. A police officer will announce taser. Absolutely. Or tasing.
Yes, I did.
So that makes it interesting to me that this man didn't announce it. So that calls into question his account a little bit.
His defense. Yeah. I mean, in the movie, it just shows he just grabbed a service weapon and just shot him. And it was just like an automatic reflex, like no thought.
And
I
would encourage everyone. I know it's really hard. I know we're going through something that is unprecedented. And I don't know if we've ever been through anything like this in our history, but I would encourage people to watch the actual video. And I know how hard it is. But I think it's important as an American to do that. But in the video, I don't see him. I don't hear him saying that either. So I'm not just going based on what happens in the film, but what was recorded on a cell phone. And what's interesting about this movie, or about this incident, not the film itself, is this really is what started the trend of people pulling out their cell phones whenever they see a black person interacting with a police officer. And I think that,
I mean, just police in general. I mean, you see a lot of people filming their interactions with the police.
Yeah, which I can say, and then I'd like your perspective, because I'm sure there's some added tenseness and weight that comes from it. But I do think that's one positive that has come from all this unspeakable death and suffering and loss and I think we as a people have realized that it's our job to keep the systems we have in place accountable and the people that we have serving us accountable. And I think that's a positive thing. But I would like to hear from what you feel about cops being recorded. Would that, I don't know if you ever experienced that when you were in the serving, would that make it harder to do your job? Would it make it easier? Obviously not easier, but what is your opinion about that?
It definitely wouldn't make the job harder. I know. So I was a police officer when I was 22 years old. That's when I first started. I am 38 now. So it's 2004 and I'm going through the police academy. And I know that when I worked on the streets, we didn't have cameras. We had a recording device, and that recording device was activated when you turned your sirens on. And so we didn't have a body camera. And so in order to record your interactions, you had a microphone, and then you were pretty much standing in front of your squad car. And that's what would be recording the video interaction. Even if you weren't standing in front of your squad car, what you're saying is being recorded. So I know that that's the recording device that I wore when I was serving. In fact, I served with the Fayetteville Police Department, Fayetteville, North Carolina. That's where I served.
Thank you for sharing that. No, I don't know what I was getting at. So anyway, it's tangent aside. I did want to finish talking about the film so we can kind of get to more thoughts. At that point, Oscar Grant has been shot by that cop. He is shot in the back. It looks like, and I need to watch the video again, but it looks like it's just below. Is it near his lungs? Or I'm trying to think of where the placement was.
Yeah, so
it was lower, like up, yeah. Like mid back, right?
It was, yeah. So shot in the back. Can't remember exactly, but the doctor said, you know, in the movie, that they had to remove his right lung. And yeah. That he had to be hooked up to a breathing machine.
And I can tell you that when I saw that, I was sobbing again watching this film last night. I was sobbing from the last 25 minutes. I was in hysterics, and it was a difficult watch. But I thought about, you know, now the refrain that has become kind of a cry for justice of "I can't breathe," which is, you know, a very obviously, famously, George Floyd uttered those words, and Eric Garner. Yep. And so I thought about that when I heard about his lung.
From then on to through the rest of the movie, it's tough. It really is, because, you know, once the doctor comes in, you know, breaks the news that he died, his mom wants to see him. She can't even hug him because at that point his death had been ruled as a homicide. This man's body is now evidence. Yeah. And the last time, you know, obviously, before the funeral, is she sees her son laying on a metal slab in a morgue, you know, right there in the hospital. And I mean, for a mom to see that, because, you know, I often hear parents say that, you know, that I shouldn't be burying my kid. My kid should be burying me, you know. I mean, those are words, you know. I don't know what it's like to be a parent. I don't have any kids. But, I mean, those words carry serious weight.
Yeah. Very, very much. Even just talking about it is almost bringing me to tears again.
I'm catching myself, too. Yeah.
All right. The film then cuts to some actual footage of the morning after, and this is the first protest in this modern era of police brutality that definitely carried more weight in light of recent events, and that's where the film ends, is with these people gathering over for Oscar's death. And am I missing anything there? I'm trying to think of what exactly happens.
Before it gets to that scene, you know, his girlfriend, you know, Safina, she, you know, goes to pick up her daughter.
Oh, that's right. And I said that the movie does not end with that, the people of the protest. It ends with her. So continue, sorry.
Well, actually, yeah, it does end with the actual footage. In fact, the footage was like four years later.
Okay.
But the last scene is, you know, really the mom. She doesn't even tell her, you know,
I his thought that...
daughter. But the last word spoken on screen was, "Where's daddy?" And then it cuts to black.
That's right. They're in the shower. Mm-hmm. She's stripped down, got in the shower, taken her baby in there, and is having, you know, basically a full on breakdown. And that's when she asks her mom, "Where's daddy?" And then it cuts.
And then it cuts, and then it goes, and, you know, it says, you know, 2013, And yeah, they're holding, like a memorial or, vigil in remembrance of Oscar Grant.
Yeah.
And I mean, thinking about that too, when, that took place, the year before, you had the Trayvon Martin incident.
Yep.
And this film was released in the summer of 2013, where the verdict for the Trayvon Martin case came back. And I mean, for folks to hear that verdict come back from the jury, it's just fresh wounds all over again.
Yep. And at that time we're all hoping and praying that, please let this be the last murder. Please let this be the last black man that's killed or black woman that's killed. I don't want to forget people like Breonna Taylor, or I feel like people keep on forgetting to mention. Yeah, it's a sobering reality. I want to talk about, because I am the white man here and I acknowledge my privilege, I want to talk about your experience, Justin, as a black man growing up, how your experience with cops shaped your opinions. I want to know a little bit more about you as a person. I think I want to shift this a little bit away from film.
I mean, for me, I mean, if somebody asked me, have I ever experienced racism? Always say, are we talking about overt, like just straight up in your face, been called racial slurs and all that? No. Maybe some people say things when I'm not around. But up to my face and stuff like that. I think the most I've ever had was when I was a teen and, the conven going to like a little drugstore, convenience store, and go to buy something, and when you're being followed.
Yeah.
And I've been followed around a couple of times, and shoot, for me, it's like, if I know you're following me, you better have your walking shoes on because I'm about to wear you out. I'm gonna walk you all over that store straight up. And then I probably won't buy nothing, but I just know I have the satisfaction of making you look like a dumbass. while they probably got robbed by somebody actually who was there to shoplift or whatever, while they're focused on me. But other than that, no. But I mean, so another little tidbit about myself, Latter-day Saint. Not currently practicing, but I've made a lot of trips out to Utah, and it's not to talk bad about the people in Utah, but you can just tell people. I mean, for anybody who's never been to Utah, let's be real, it's quite homogenous. I'm not saying
Yeah.
that in a bad way. That is the population demographics of Utah. I mean, there's like what? I
There's
think.
probably what, like 10 black people in Utah. I'm just kidding, of
If
course.
that,
But I'm not I'm
and it might be all in Salt Lake. I don't know. I mean, I think the population, the black or like minority population of Utah is like 2% out of like 2.5 million total population. So to put that in perspective.
And I would say predominantly that's a lot of them would be considered Latinx or Latina, however you choose to identify.
Which is funny because, people ask me, what's your favorite city in Utah? And I say Ogden, and people look at me like, ew, really? Ogden? Don't, hey, Ogden, that's my spot. That's my spot. And it's probably because it's a little more diverse. I mean, I love Salt Lake, but I mean, let's be real. If I go to a Walmart and let's say, I don't know, Bountiful or what's that? Circleville?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, anybody who's familiar with that stretch of I-15 in the Wasatch Valley, I mean, it's pretty homogenous. If I go in a store, if I see another brother, we're probably gonna give a the universal head nod, like, "What's up?" Because we don't know each other. It's just, "Hey, man, I see you." That's just a cultural thing.
I want to say, because I'm also from Utah, and I think I can comfortably say at this point that I was raised in a family. Wouldn't say they were outwardly racist, but I would say that because of what Justin was talking about, there's just no diversity in Salt Lake and in Utah in general. I think it insulates you, and you're exposed to the sameness, and nothing challenges you. I would definitely say that I am definitely fighting my own racism every single day, and my own prejudices. I don't know with 100% certainty, but there is say that my great grandfather on my dad's side, he was definitely what is the term in Utah? I have heard tell that he was part of the Ku Klux Klan. And that's something pretty heavy and weighted to say. So that's just to acknowledge that I am certainly far from perfect. And I think it's my job and our job as any white people listening to every single day to acknowledge not only our privilege, but to acknowledge our own biases and racist tendencies, whether they're overt or
covert.
No, pervert. Yeah.
I'm just being honest, like when I know in Utah, you know, I've had some people, I always say when somebody's trying to say some slick shit, and that's really, I guess that's the most of my experience, is just when somebody tries to say some slick shit, like, oh man, you're so well spoken. I'm like, well, what did you think I was gonna sound like or talk like, you know? Or, you know, or like somebody might, you know, you can tell when somebody's trying a little too hard. Like,
yep.
You just start to bring up like just things like, for some reason, I don't know if it's like everybody, like they think all black people love Jay-Z, and it's like, man, I mean, yeah, I mean, he got some all right songs, I guess, but you know that I'm definitely more into like, you know, alt rock. I mean, if you want to talk about U2 and REM and stuff like that, hey, I'm your man. I'm just not big pimping like that, you know. but that's what I mean though. And the thing, so for a lot of people who don't probably know this about me, I am also, you know, happen to lean a bit more on the right side of things. So yeah, I am a conservative, libertarian, probably mostly. And so I do think PC culture has played into this as well. And I think that has prevented us from having honest conversations about certain things, because now we've become so afraid to say things of offending people. And that's a problem too. And, you know, I always say one of the worst things somebody can say to a black person or a person of color is, I don't see color. I'm like, wow, really? Because yeah, honestly, if you don't see color, then you are not seeing an aspect of me. It's not just because that's the only thing about me, but you're not seeing the totality, the whole person. And so I think that that type of thinking, even though it's well-intentioned, it could do more harm than good. I mean, I've actually, no joke, as an officer, had a person who was so afraid to just describe what a person looks like to me, it made it hard for me to get a description of who I'm looking for, because she couldn't say it was a black guy. Yeah. I'm like, you know, I'm going to need you to give me some real heavy duty descriptors to let me know who I'm looking for. It's okay to acknowledge somebody is black. It's okay to acknowledge that somebody is, you know, whatever their, you know, nationality or whatever is.
Yeah.
And, you know, that feeling of, you know, I don't need people to feel guilty. I just need people to really do better and be aware.
It's interesting as we're talking about this, speaking of the film we're talking about, kind of breaking news. Well, not breaking news, but I guess Michael B. Jordan just spoke in one of the LA protests. And one of the poll quote was investing in black staff. I thought that would be interesting to add to it. He says, go ahead.
And I know, like, I think it was a couple of years ago at the Oscars. Uh-huh. And you heard some of the you know, the nominees and winners talk about something called the inclusion rider, which was to make sure that the cast and crew on a production was really diverse.
Yeah.
Because even Hollywood itself, I mean, for as I guess, you know, open-minded as they may think they are, they still got a long way to go too.
100%. And that steers it back to you know, to film and to kind of what I like to think that this podcast is getting at is relating how movies have that really implicit power to change people, and art in general, but in this case, film. And you know, in one of those things, one of the ways that they have, one of the things that they can really truly change about someone is exposing people to other types of people, other types of opinions, other types of cultures. And if they're not doing that, then they're definitely part of the problem. And, you know, so it's important for them to give platforms to a diverse, wide-ranging group of people. So.
Absolutely. And that's my favorite thing about film is the fact that for the most part, stories are universal. You may not always look like the characters on screen or may not exactly identify with the character on screen, but stories have a way of being universal. Yeah. And, you know, for me, I know that film was like that window to really opening up my horizons. I love foreign films. Yeah. And particularly films out of the United Kingdom, Korean cinema. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I got there, when I actually got to go to Korea and the UK, you know, you got to always be, you know, careful to make sure that, you know, what you see on screen, you're not applying that to a whole group of people, but yeah. You sort of have an understanding and context of where you are, even though you have never been there before. But you sort of have an idea about the culture and where you're at and, you know, where you're at. It just helps you a little more aware.
100%. Sorry to cut you off there. No, what I was going to say is speaking as someone from Salt Lake and from Utah, I actually might be able to honestly say that the first time I ever saw a Black person was on the television screen or on the movie screen. And that's a weird reality. And that seems even more far-fetched as our country wonderfully so gets more diverse and more, more voices I'm spacing my words here, but that was my reality. And I think that might be some people, you know, in the Midwest, I think that might be their reality as well. So it is Hollywood's job to make sure to expose people to things that they wouldn't be exposed to living in, you know, their sheltered town. So
I could definitely tell you when I got my orders that I was going to be stationed in South Dakota, I was like, whoo, South Dakota. I was like, is that even still a part of the United States? I was like, man. I don't know. I sort of had an idea I was going there. My recruiter was sharing it with me, so I can't say my recruiter lied to me. But when I got there, now, of course, when I got to the base, military bases are diverse, even if the host community or town is not so much diverse. Military bases have a way of sort of making a community more diverse. And I could definitely tell you, and I love South Dakota and I love my time in Ellsworth and Rapid City. But yeah, I mean, definitely when I went into town and stuff like that, you can just tell. And they're not backwards there or anything like that either. But there are just some folks who probably just don't have really a lot of interaction with people who just don't look like them. And it's not a horrible thing. That is just the United States and every state is different. And some populations just tend to be a little more diverse or a little more homogenous. But it's always an opportunity for somebody to get to know you. If people are open to that.
Very much. It's interesting because I don't know if I've discussed this on the podcast quite yet, but I am a proud gay man, and I am so grateful every single day to be exactly who I am, to be a proud gay man and to be who I am. And I feel like if it wasn't for my sexuality, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. And I also, I wouldn't have the amount of empathy for others that I claim to have, or that I feel that I have. And I say that also as a gay man, knowing that it gives me a kind of a bridge to be able to connect with others that are also discriminated against because of something, you know, that they can't control. But I also want to acknowledge that as a gay man, I can turn that, like, I can just say, I don't have to mention my sexual orientation. So I could play straight and someone wouldn't notice, you know, they would treat me as just a normal white person. You know, if that isn't the case for you, Justin, or for any person of color, I don't mean to speak for you, but that's the difference.
And that's just what being aware is all about. And the thing is, so I'm queer as well. I have a partner. And so, I mean, that part of my life, yeah, if somebody didn't see me holding my partner's hand in public, they wouldn't know that part about my life. But, and the thing is with me too, being Black, you know, I get mistaken for everything but being Black. Because for a lot of people, I get the question, what are you, a lot? Because for some folks, I'm racially ambiguous. I'm Black. That's my race, my ethnicity. I am Puerto Rican. My mom was born in Ohio. My dad was born on the island. He was born in Puerto Rico. I don't really speak a lot of Spanish. So, I mean, let's put it this way. If somebody wanted to commit a hate crime on me, they would hit the payload. I'm Black. I'm queer. I mean, it's just like, damn, what are we charging with? You know? Yeah, that's just who I am. But I will always tell people this, even with intersectionality, being Black and gay or Black and queer, I'm Black first. That's just the first thing people are going to notice and see. And like I said, that's not a bad thing.
No.
But, you know, people tend to really judge things just on looks alone. That's just, maybe that's just a human thing. I don't know, but that's just a reality.
And I feel like in some way we went the pendulum swing, you know, when, you know, the MLK assassination, there was this giant pendulum swing and it swung from one way all the way to the other. And we thought that things were fixed. And I think that at that point, that refrain of, oh, I don't see color, I feel like that's when things like that started to hear those things more and more. And I feel like we're realizing that is part of a broken system. Like, for us to really fix what the problem, I think we need to acknowledge skin color and we need to be comfortable acknowledging that.
That's how I feel. It's like who I am, like the most salient characteristics, the things that you can see outwardly, just keep in mind that that's not all a person is. Yep. While, you know, I think that, you know, when people say, I don't see color, the thing is, you should just not see only color.
Yes.
Not to just not see it at all, but that just should not be the only thing that you see.
And I think as someone that I could almost see myself as saying something like that in the past, I feel like it, and forgive me, anyone that's listening that has said this in the past or currently does say something to that effect. I think it's almost covering for some little bits of maybe racist tendencies or opinions without you being comfortable enough at this time to acknowledge them. Like I said earlier, I acknowledge that every day I acknowledge that my privilege and my racist tendencies, I acknowledge that's an ever ongoing battle. And I think that's the place that we have to be as white people. I think that's our responsibility as human beings. I think it's just to acknowledge our failings. I think we get a lot further along if we just started with our failings and acknowledged those and then went forward. I think that is a small, and I can't claim to be able to solve the problems we're going through right now. But I feel like that's a small nugget of what's happening with our police system. Is I feel like it's a system that, because of human beings and our desire to want to be okay and to want to be decent and good, which is a good thing, I think we need to get better at acknowledging our own faults and being okay with not only fessing up to those, but being okay that is a never ending process. It's that we want simple answers. We want easy fixes, and systemic racism and police brutality are things that we're not going to fix easily. They're going to take a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of problem solving. And it's so anyway, that's just my two cents.
Yeah, it's going to take everybody. Really, it's what it's going to come down to. I can definitely tell you from the law enforcement perspective, we always have the saying, once a cop, always a cop. And I guess maybe how I approach things. I mean, I'm a financial analyst for the United States Air Force. So even, you know, when I'm researching something, you know, just asking the right questions and, you know, going to people, and when I want information, you know, how I'm interacting with those people. And I think when it comes to policing, I don't know what they're teaching in police training nowadays. But I mean, the things that I remember when I went through police training, there was an emphasis on really remembering that you are a part of the community that you are policing. And really, it's about serving, because that's what police officers are. They are a servant of the people, not like in a subservient way, but they're supposed to be there for the people and upholding the public trust. And really, if you think about it, it's sort of like a contract between the agency, the law enforcement agency, and the community it is supposed to be serving. And both sides have to uphold their end of that agreement.
Yeah.
And on the police perspective, a big problem is holding those who do not do that accountable. It comes down to a lot of accountability. I think also other issues are that police are definitely under-trained. Mm-hmm. 6 months is not enough time in a classroom to really verse somebody on policing. And then you have the classroom time. You have the time with your field training officer, you know, out there on the streets, because some of the most important lessons are not learned in the classroom. They're learned right there on the streets. Police officers are asked to do a lot and to deal with all types of people. I mean, how many police officers are really trained to deal with people who have mental health issues?
Yep. It's funny you mentioned that, because I've been thinking about that the last few days. I was like, what if we were to take that responsibility away from police officers? And I can't claim to be the one that's thought of this, because I've read many more well-read people that have talked about this. But what if we had crisis counselors and mental health experts that were addressing those needs? Someone that's talking to themselves on the street, instead of sending a cop, we send a mental health expert and we fix the problem. We get to the root of it. Instead of, you know, it also avoids people getting stuck in this, you know, cycle that just never ends. And, you know, taking that workload off people that, you know, not only is their workload high, but, you know, I mean, right now, public trust is probably at an all-time low.
It's at an all-time low. It's not even just policing. People don't even trust the government. But yeah. I ain't even gonna get into that right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, people don't even trust. They don't even trust the government. So, no. And the thing is, police officers they're overworked.
Yeah.
They are undertrained. They are underpaid. And on top of that, they're in a lot of cities that, frankly, just can't seem to balance a budget and a checkbook. They have been turned into a revenue generating apparatus that write people up just for anything. And normally the communities that are targeted for that are communities of color and poor people. Mm-hmm. And if you can't afford the fine, then you end up in jail. And it just becomes this cycle.
Yep.
I always thought, you know, Fruitvale Station is the story of America. It's an American story.
Yeah.
And an 85-minute feature definitely won't even gloss over all the horrible ingredients for this recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Won't even begin to scratch the surface. But just coming from, you know, the law enforcement perspective, I have also had an encounter with law enforcement where, you know, before I moved back to Colorado, police responding to the wrong address, my address instead of the address they were supposed to respond to, kicked in my door while I was cooking and I had guns drawn on me. So, I mean, I'm like, you know, I don't want to mention her name, a certain conservative pundit who pretty much just went on a rant this week. She made the suggestion that Black people should minimize their interaction with law enforcement police. And when she said that, I'm like, wow. So when I was in my apartment cooking, I don't think I was inviting the police over for some tacos, but here they are, four guys, guns in my face, where I really had to de-escalate my situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I was holding a spatula that maybe could have been mistaken for a gun.
Yeah.
I pretty much let them cuff me. Because I knew that any resistance on my part, even though I did nothing wrong, could probably be the difference between me being here talking to you right now or being laid 6 feet under and possibly becoming a hashtag. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is a reality. And my experiences are not going to be every other Black person's experience. We are not a monolith.
No.
But for me to not even, and I think that's a problem, just lack of empathy and genuine listening to at least understand that, I mean, I definitely know that there are experiences in life that you have had or may have that I am not going to go through, and that I am going to have experiences in my life that I have had or may go through that you are not going to experience. But maybe understanding and empathy and listening, and when I say listening to not craft a response, but just genuine listening, that maybe something productive may actually happen. Because right now, you just have everybody just shouting over each other. And I think now there are a lot more people listening. And I hope that sensible reforms will actually occur so that if you think about it, I mean, I love my country. I'll say that flat out right now. I probably have loved this country more than it has probably ever loved me. In some sense, when I think about today, and it's the anniversary of D-Day, and how during World War II, my grandfather served in World War II on my mom's side, and you have soldiers, Black soldiers, serving in segregated units, and you have soldiers who are fighting a foreign enemy while also having to fight just for basic civil rights back home. That's something to put into perspective, you know. It's a totality, you know, perspective. I mean, these are things to keep in mind. At one time when the United States Supreme Court case, Plessy versus Ferguson, made segregation legal. And then close to 50 years later, you have Brown versus Board of Education. And you sort of have, you know, in parts of the country, integration happening while another part of the country wants to hang on to segregation. And even though the laws have changed, it doesn't mean that people's attitudes, minds, and heart will change, or at least not immediately. So we are still having these problems that we thought were solved here in 2020. I think maybe at some point, no, not maybe at some point, at some point, we as everybody, as people, citizens of this country, fell asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. You put that perfectly. And I thank you so much for sharing all that. I wanted to fit in a quote that I had heard in a podcast just the other day, and I credit this to the podcast that I was referring to just yesterday, and that is Pod Save America, I believe is how Pod Save the People, excuse me, and I misquoted
I'll have
earlier.
To look that up.
It's a fantastic podcast, and in it, one of the hosts, she was talking about her own experience, her own experiences in the last, you know, few weeks. And she closed with this. It was, justice is what Cornel West calls what loves look like, what love looks like in public. And I, for some reason, that really stuck with me. And it feels like we're getting there. And it feels like there's hope in that statement, and there's hope in what we're going through as a country. And I feel like what's happening is we're facing our demons head on, and we're not allowing them to be pulled underneath the covers anymore. We're not allowing them to be you know, pushed away or for us to be silenced by. And I someone was talking about this earlier, and I think this is very succinct and very well put. I think this pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, has given us the opportunity to really sit and think with the problem of systemic racism and police brutality. And I feel like we, if it wasn't for this pandemic and that time that it's offered us because of, you know, are, you know, silly things that we use to gloss over real issues. Because of that, we've really opened up this wound. We finally let the wound fully open and exposed it for what it is. And I feel like that's the only way that it can truly heal. And if that's, you know, one positive thing that can come out of all this, then that's wonderful, you know.
I agree. This, you know, I normally return to, you know, the pandemic as the event. This is not the first pandemic in history. This is just probably the first pandemic that you and I have gone through. Yep. But yeah, this moment right now has definitely taken the sails out of all of us. And one of the silver linings, I think, and even in these moments, there are silver linings, is that it gives us a moment to really think about, you know, where we were, you know, pre-COVID, PC, pre-COVID, and then, well, PC again, post-COVID, I guess. Where were we? Where do we want to be? Because I know for the longest time I had a problem saying new normal, and still not really fond of that phrase, but this is a moment to where we can try to emerge from this much better. I think we should definitely take that opportunity to really do that. And I honestly, it's not to be pessimistic, but as long as human beings are on this planet, myself included, a lot of problems are probably just never going to get fully resolved. Mm-hmm. I just think we can just be a hell of a whole lot better and do a hell of a whole lot better than what we were doing before and now.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I'm almost feeling like we should end it there. unless there's anything else you want to add. I do want to leave this with some hope. I do feel like, as I was saying earlier, I feel like we've reached the point. There's many times in history where I feel like we've thought we've reached a point of no return, and you know, we keep on saying that over and over, but I feel like at this point in our history we really have reached a point of no return. And I think if we can do this with what's going on with, you know, with racism and police brutality, imagine if we can do this with, you know, climate change, if we as people really, you know, unite like we have been with, you know, I was at a protest today in Palm Springs. I was there on Monday, and seeing everyone united in one cause, you know, and a lot of, I feel like it's reaching across the aisle a little bit. And a lot of people are stepping up, people that maybe wouldn't have before. If we can do that, you know, for, you know, even bigger problems like climate change, then, you know, I really have hope in us as people and our species, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, when the protests, and I'm sure for some folks listening out there, me saying protests, they're probably going to scoff at that and just automatically call it a riot and looting, and they're more than welcome to their opinion. But there are people out there actually protesting, more than people actually being distractors who are looting, and they just want to use this as an opportunity for their own destructive and chaotic and anarchic, if that's a real word, ends. And I, you know, from all over the world, I mean, Tokyo, Greece, London, I mean, all over the world, this has the world's attention right now. And, you know, as we were talking earlier before we started recording, right now the pressures are being kept up. And as long as that message is getting out there and, you know, sensible reforms and changes are taking place and real productive dialogue, and that dialogue also includes listening as well, is taking place, then yeah, we can definitely, you know, make the changes that we need to change that actually will benefit everybody. You know, I don't say Black Lives Matter often, not because I don't believe Black Lives Matter. Yes, of course, Black Lives Matter. That's just saying it just matters, period. It's not saying it matters more than another life, or that it's, you know, more important than anybody else. That's just a saying, you know. There's nothing else added after that. That's it. It's just one simple statement. But we all around, we all got to do better. You're definitely more optimistic than I am. I'm a little more optimistic than I used to be. Yeah. But I mean, I keep in mind too that we have always been a species on the brink, and maybe that's just where we like to reside. I just truly believe that. I'm a Cold War kid. Yeah. I know sometimes I catch myself saying, "Ah, man, I missed the Cold War," but we've always been on the brink, always.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just what makes us human.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I think I'm going to leave it there. Justin, thank you so, so much for joining me today. This was a really, really amazing discussion, and I really appreciate you, and I love you, man. And yeah, you guys take care. Wishing you all love. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for tuning in. Bye-bye.